Welcome to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Our focus is commercial real estate, exploring vital questions confronting commercial landlords, property and asset managers, investors, brokers, tenants, and anyone providing services to the industry. Your host is Howard Klein. His commercial real estate practice over 35 years has concentrated on broker, leasing, and property management issues. CRE Radio broadcasts are presented with the sole intent of educating listeners. Howard and his guests are specifically not offering legal advice. If you need legal advice, consult your own counsel. CRE Radio is available live and downloadable anytime at creradio.com. Call in during the live show with your comments or questions, 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue. And now, here's Howard Klein.
Hello, and welcome to CRE Radio. I'm your host, Howard Klein. Today's topic, or better said, today's interview, is with Rand Sperry. Rand is one of the founders of Sperry Van S, and I will put in this disclaimer right now. Rand is no longer with Sperry Van S, but he'll talk about that. I consider Rand a real estate icon. If you'd like to ask any questions or leave comments, our call-in number is 619-393-6492. Press 1 to be put into the queue. You could also leave comments on Twitter using the @ CRE Radio, or questions at creradio.com, or finally, other comments can be left directly on our website at creradio.com/shows/Rand-Sperry. So now, without further ado, let's speak to Rand. Hello, Rand. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Howard?
I'm doing great. So the first question I'd like to ask of you, Rand, is I called you a real estate icon. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think I feel kind of a little embarrassed. I mean, I certainly don't consider myself an icon in the business. An old guy might be more appropriate after 37 years in this business. But I don't know. When I think of icon, I think of, you know, the Donald Trumps of the world, and I certainly don't fit in that category. So I guess that's why I don't look at myself that way.
Well, Donald Trump, yes, would be an icon. John Cushman would be an icon. But I also consider you to be an icon. You've been at this a long time. You've had a considerable amount of success. You're well known in the industry. I certainly would put you in that category. I don't think that you have to have the same hairdo as Donald, and you don't have to have buildings named after him to be an icon. But I consider you as such. But you're just being modest, right?
Well, in the sense that. I guess if you look at it in terms of how much mass fortune have you accumulated, yeah, I don't fit into that category. But I think, I've certainly had an impact here in Southern California, and then taking the company national over the last 12 years and being part of that until recently. I think it, my name is out there. When I do get into conversations with people, even in different states, and especially in the big city, and anyone who's an investor, an active investor in real estate, they've certainly heard of Sperry Van S, and in many cases they've heard of me personally. And I got to tell you, it's kind of interesting, Howard. A number of times I'll be telling people, yeah, you know, where do you work? And I said, well, I'm with Sperry Van S, and they'd say, I'm Rand Sperry, and they just – don't connect the dots that I might be the co-founder of the company. And I have to actually say that, well, I'm Rand Sperry. I co-founded the company, and they almost are like shocked. Like, I'm not sure why, other than maybe they think I'm dead or I. So like many of the founders of large national real estate companies. So it is kind of funny that they don't connect the dots that they're actually talking to the guy who founded the company.
No,
and I kind of go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the first time I met you, I hear the name Rand Sperry, and I go, well, he must be the Sperry in Sperry Van Ness. It never even dawned on me that you wouldn't be.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what it is, and especially when I'm talking to a local broker, because we do acquire property through Sperry Equities around the country, and I'll actually go on the due diligence on these properties and mention my name, and they just don't connect it. Or in some cases, too, in social circles, they think I'm the son of the founder. So
well, that's because you look so young.
Yeah, right.
That's why
I used to.
You and me both. So why don't we talk a little bit about what led up to your involvement in commercial real estate? What was your background that led you to get involved in commercial real estate?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, my career in commercial real estate is, Howard, maybe perhaps similar to your career in law, in that this is what I started out to do, and I'm still doing it. I haven't had a change in careers, and but when I first went to college, I was really on track to become an attorney. I was going to go to law school, and it wasn't until about sophomore year in college that I was transitioning from a local community college to a four-year college, Cal State Long Beach. I was actually applying at USC as well, and that I kind of thought of, do I really want to go into law? And I thought, well, I'm still going to pursue that, but I'm going to be a business major as my minor degree. So what happened was, the market, it was about 1976, and houses, you know, we're kind of having what's going on a little bit today in that things are starting to escalate a little. They were kind of flat for 4 or 5, 6 years, and the market was starting to take off, and real estate seemed to be starting to be on the move. And my father, who has nothing to do with real estate, but he reads the paper, and he was very involved in what's happening, and he said, you know, if law isn't your track, then you should be a commercial real estate broker. So those are the two areas you really should set your sights on. And the reason he wanted me to become a lawyer is because his older brother was a lawyer, and we had a couple of cousins that were lawyers. So there was kind of lawyers in the family, and of course they all did well. And so but he had a friend growing up that became super successful as a developer in Chicago. To the point where he had a 640-acre estate in Barrington, Illinois. He owned a lot of land out there. He was developing, and, you know, it was just his buddy in high school. And they still kept in touch and were friends. And so he really got enthused about commercial real estate. And he kind of pushed me in that direction when I was in college. And he also said to me something interesting. He says, you know, what you need to do is become a landlord, start acquiring, we talked about residential properties and apartments at that time, and he said, this way no one is beholden to any one employer. You know, you create a passive income for yourself so you never have to depend on anyone else. I'll never forget that, because here's a guy who was basically got his, he never finished high school, and then he finished. When I was a little kid, he went to, you know, the extended school and got his GED. And so he was just street smart. He really had great advice for me as I was going through college for someone who really wasn't a business person. And that made a lot of sense to me. And so I bought a fourplex when I was 20.
Wow.
And that was really the thing I had saved up. I worked hard. I mean, one of the ingredients, obviously, to any type of success in any business is you got to be a hard worker. You can't be lazy. And it's just not going to come to you. Don't try playing the lotto to become a millionaire. You have to get in there, roll your sleeves up, and work. And so I did that even in high school. I had a part-time job after school. I supported myself in terms of my car and gas and insurance. And then I actually saved during college, because I decided to go to Cal State Long Beach and not pay the expense of tuition. I saved up about $10,000 to $12,000, and I put it down on a fourplex in Long Beach. I became the landlord. I became the gardener, the maintenance person. I did everything on that that property. I negotiated with the tenants as they moved in, and I'm 20 years old, and I was earning $200 a month. This is 1975, and that's $2,400 a year. And Howard, you do the math. That's 24% on a $10,000 investment. So that was pretty good. And I thought, wait a minute, this is really amazing. I love this real estate. And then I sold the property as a senior in college for an additional $16,000. I walked away with $26,000 when I graduated from high school, I mean from college rather, in 1970, let's see, I graduated in 76. So that was pretty amazing. And
you were a
that's when I decided, pardon
you were,
me?
You were a natural.
Yeah. I had the passion. I mean, imagine, you know, putting $11,000 in a deal, getting $2,400 or $200 a month in cash flow for about 18 months to 2 years, and then doubling my money as a bonus. I mean, I thought, why isn't everybody doing this? And so so I literally started looking in the newspaper for a job getting out of college in commercial real estate. And, of course, I did interview with Coal Banker, was really where my dad suggested I go because they were the largest brokerage company in the in the country even then. And you know, they wanted to put you on $1,000 a month salary and then be a slave for 2 years. You sign a 2-year contract and you work for somebody. And you know, I don't disagree with that program. I you know, it really makes sense because it's still done today. And in fact, in growing you know, the Sperry Van Ness and even Sperry Commercial here now, we use that program. I mean, that was a program that some of the brokers wanted to do, and so they would do the same thing, charge or pay $1,000 a month to have someone intern for them for a couple of years.
Sure.
But I wasn't that type. I was like, no, I want to make money now, and so I just jumped into it, and I found a company called the Haynes Company. I think Howard, you may have heard of them.
Sure.
Haynes.
Yeah.
Bruce Haynes. He was here in Southern California.
Yeah, Rand, why don't we take a break for our sponsors, and we'll continue on with the Haynes Company as soon as we get back, okay?
Okay, sure.
If you're a retail tenant, you really should belong to the NRTA. They're an organization of the tenants, by the tenants, and for the tenants. Whether you manage a large portfolio or just a mom and pop, the National Retail Tenants Association is on your side. NRTA exists to protect retail tenants everywhere and to make sure landlord billings are correct. Don't wait for your next statement of CAM charges to arrive. Log on to retailtenants.org. That's retailtenants.org. Find out more today. What's next for commercial real estate and retail marketing? Pop-up retail. And it's here now. PopUpInsider.com is the premier online resource for owners to advertise and fill properties for temporary use. PopUpInsider.com is where merchants and brands shop for temporary locations. See for yourself. Go to PopUpInsider.com, create your own account, market your empty spaces, or view available locations for your business. All on one convenient site, PopUpInsider.com.
This is Commercial Real Estate Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a comment for Howard or his guests, please call 619-393-6492. That's area 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Okay, welcome back to CRE Radio with our special guest, Rand Sperry. So, Rand, where were we? We were talking about Haynes, correct?
Yeah, we were talking about where I first went to work.
Sure.
And it was really because I did so well with this fourplex, this small little apartment building, that I said, I am so sold on this that everyone should do it. It was like I wanted to spread the good word and about real estate. And so I started there in their office in San Marino. It's right next to Pasadena, California. and it was his third office. He eventually opened, I think, two or three more, and they specialized in apartments. And it's kind of funny. Bruce Haynes had come from a company called Atherton Clemens up in Northern California, and another young man at the time was worked side by side with Bruce Haynes, and his name was George Marcus. And eventually, George Marcus started a firm called Marcus Millichap, and in Northern California. And Bruce Haynes came down to Southern California and started the Haynes Company. So, to give your listeners an understanding, the Haynes Company is pretty similar to the Marcus Millichap Company at the time, and they were really quite the competitor in Southern California when Marcus Millichap eventually came down to Southern California in 1980.
Rand,
so
let me step back a second, because I'm curious. When you were 20 years old and you purchased this fourplex, how did you know whether or not you were buying it at the? How did you know what you were doing?
Well, you know, I have to tell you, Howard, I look back now and I realize that I should have knocked on the door of a real estate company and gotten some guidance, because I didn't. I didn't know what I was doing. I looked in the newspaper. Back then, you could look in the LA Times, section 4000, I believe it was, and you could see, you know, real estate for sale, income units for sale was the title. And I called on a few, and I actually was trying to buy an 8-unit in Silver Lake, and I missed out. I was, you know, competing with another person to buy that property, and it was directly to owner to principal. And the same thing with this fourplex. I answered a for sale by owner, and so I wasn't represented. I did this on my own. And by the way, during that, I should mention, I didn't have my real estate license when I bought this property. That's right. I didn't know what I was doing. I just, you know, there were comps in the area that suggested that I was paying the right price. But I have to tell you, after I bought it, I talked to a few people who owned property in the neighborhood, and they thought I overpaid. They did say, "You paid $45,000 for that fourplex?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I wouldn't have paid that." So I got to tell you, my heart sunk into my stomach after talking to a few people, because they felt I did overpay for it. But it turned out that perhaps I could have got a better buy in the neighborhood, but I still did okay. You know, in other words, the market saved me more than anything, I think, in that particular acquisition. So.
Well, that's important. I think the lesson from that is, well, I'm not sure I could say this, but in some instances, particularly in your case, just do it. And maybe your instincts, you know, were great at that time, as they've proven to be over the years. Have you never made a mistake on an investment?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Actually, recently. In the 2007, 2008, when the market crashed, some of the acquisitions, of course, did not turn out well. But in the early years, here's the mistakes that I made in the beginning. And that was that, for example, I believe with that $11,000 in early 1975, had I gone to a Bruce Haynes company, which existed in Southern California, had I knocked on the door of their Beverly Hills office with my $11,000 investment, I think they could have turned it into $50,000 or $100,000 in that period of time versus $25,000. Because when I look back, it was not that good of an investment that I made compared to talking to others who bought properties in that same year and did much better than I did. In fact, I talked to one person who bought a home for $50,000 and within 18 months sold it for like $75,000. So I didn't really think I was quite brilliant at the time, because I realized there were other people actually performing better with the same amount of money at the same time. So the lesson I learned is, until you think you know more than the advisor or the, you know, seek advice. And that's the lesson I learned, is had I talked to somebody who had 5 or 10 years either owning or brokering apartment buildings, I think they could have put me in a better valued property. I really do. So,
do you regret doing what you did?
No. Of course, I don't regret it. Looking back, I go, that was pretty daring. And you know, I never thought in my mind that I would lose my $11,000. It was never my concern. It was, you know, how much can I make? How successful will I be? But I was never in fear of losing that investment. And I think that's what holds most people back even today, and that is that they have a fear of investing or taking a chance or taking a risk. And if you don't step out there and do that in life, you just won't find the rewards commensurate to the risk. And, you know, you have a pretty boring life. And so what I did learn from that example of buying that property is that risk reward really does work. I mean, and it's great to feel it, to actually have that experience that you took a chance on something. And in, you know, early on, it's probably the dating scene. You know, you take a chance asking a girl out, thinking, no way, she's going to go out with me. She goes out with you. That's kind of a risk reward scenario. So in the financial world, it's you have to do this. Because, and this is another thing my dad taught me, says you'll never get rich, you know, working for someone, or certainly working for a salary. I mean, it's really hard to accumulate money just going to work every day. So you have to take some of that money you make from your job and invest it. And so, not to say that, you know, everyone has to be an entrepreneur to be wealthy, because we know that's not the case, but you have to set aside a certain amount of that money that you make, and you need to invest it, and you can't be afraid to invest it. You can't just put it in your savings account at, you know, 1%. You have to take some chances. And albeit I believe they should be calculated chances, calculated risk is what I call it. I rarely ever have invested in something that was, you know, well, it's either going to happen or it's not. In real estate, I look at it and go, okay, what can happen here? How much can this investment grow? And, you know, most of the time, I mean, really, and I look at my career, 95 to 98% of the time, every investment I've made, I've retained the investment and made money on the investment. I've rarely ever lost any of my investment or other people's investments, with the exception, and I'll be honest, you know, in the we had 60 properties in 2007, and we lost three or four of them to the banks. I mean, where we just said, you know, the investors didn't want to put any additional capital up, and we had to hand the keys back. And it was heartbreaking, because I'd never experienced that before. And, you know, we've learned now, you know, that we're not we're vulnerable, that you can lose money in real estate. And but prior to 2007 2008, a lot of the risks that I took, it worked. I've been very fortunate, very blessed, but I do not, for example, I don't know about you, Howard, but when I go to Vegas, I go there and I have dinners and I watch shows and I enjoy the nightlife there. I do not gamble. And people think that's ridiculous. Well, come on, let's go play the crap table.
There are calculations in gambling in Vegas, but that's very different from applying your knowledge and experience in commercial real estate. And when we come back, I'd like to talk about how you acquired that knowledge and experience that allowed you to make those calculated risks. So we'll be back in a moment.
Here's an exciting new tool for brokers and investors, RateBlend. RateBlend is a powerful online rent calculator that's quick and easy to use. Print and send detailed, effective rent analyses with a single click. RateBlend is easy to read, so what does your spreadsheet mean goes away. As a web app, RateBlend is accessible from your computer or any mobile device. Log on to creradio.com for Howard's comments, his one-on-one with developer Andrew Bermudez, and links to RateBlend. Try it today. Manage a shopping center? Always looking for new ideas? Tactics. Tactics Magazine is the idea magazine for shopping center marketing directors all over the world. Exciting promotions, gift with purchase programs, and full-blown ad campaigns. Every edition of Tactics is packed with features, ideas, and news you can use to get the word out and grow your numbers. How can you manage a shopping center without your tactics? Log on to tacticsmagazine.com. Today would be good. Tacticsmagazine.com.
This is Commercial Real Estate Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a comment for Howard or his guests, please call 619-393-6492. That's area 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Okay, welcome back to CRE Radio with Rand Sperry. We were just talking about, or going to talk about, getting into the discussion on how Rand actually accumulated his knowledge and experience, whether or not he went to school, etc. But before I get to that, but first, I just want to go to that, I want to describe how I go to Vegas. And yes, my wife and I do gamble, but we don't gamble that much. I don't like a lot of risk. What we do is we sit at the blackjack table, and I bring X amount of dollars with me, being prepared to lose that amount of money, and considering it part of my cost of entertainment. And I rarely lose all of it, because if I start getting close, then I start chickening out. But, it's just our cost of entertainment. And most of the time, I really walk away with a little bit more money. So, with that being I'm not a big risk taker, except for taking risks on myself. And isn't that what you did?
Yeah. I like your concept of going to Vegas, because I think if you do say, okay, here's $300 for the evening, this is my entertainment, and you walk away, that works. But I just what was your question, though, Howard?
Totally distracted you. Let me throw you another curveball. Why don't we talk a little bit about how you accumulated the knowledge and experience that allowed you to start making reasonable, calculated risks?
Well, I have to credit, a couple people for that. And one is, first of all, Cal State Long Beach. They had a business program, and they actually had a real estate minor that you could get in finance. And so you could graduate from the college with and go take your broker's license. So in other words, they gave you all the qualifications. And some of the courses were similar to the CCIM courses in terms of analyzing properties and the cash-on-cash return and the after-depreciation and the equity buildup and so the total return on an investment, like an internal rate of return. And so that was extremely helpful. And because I would just bought this fourplex, I could really relate to those classes. So it was a great experience to have. And then I go to work for the Haynes Company, and one of the things that they do is they say, we will train you. Well, their training consisted of a two-week, 8 hours a day for 2 weeks, training class that you attended at their corporate offices. And they walk you through cash flow analysis. And they also, of course, spend some time training you on how to sell and how to negotiate and how to sit down in front of a principal and convince them to list their property, and they talk about marketing and so on. But I would say half the class was about the analysis of the property and what to look for. And I mean, they dug down into all the expenses and capital expenses and ordinary expenses, monthly expenses, and where the revenue streams would come from, and so on, and because you had to do this for the client, and so that's really where I really learned whether or not something was a deal. And part of it was so funny, because I'll never forget when I was 20 looking for this property, some of the ads would say, you know, fourplex for sale or 10 units for sale, really low rents. And I would think to myself, why would somebody trying to sell the property want to brag about having low rents? That was my, I thought, how stupid is that? You know, and then once I went through the Bruce Haynes training course, what I realized is those are the properties you want to buy, because those are the ones that, you know, with the little TLC and what have you, you raise the rents, and
sure,
by raising the rent, you raise the value of the real estate. So that's how dumb I was at 20. I didn't understand that. So
you were a lot smarter than I was at 20.
Well, I was willing to take risk, I guess. That was, you know, the only credit I could give myself there. I was fortunate that, you know, all real estate was rising at that time. But after I got hooked in with Bruce Haynes and really understand how to figure out value and where the opportunity was, it really made a difference. And so I started acquiring real estate. But better than that, better yet, what happened was by learning the entire program from them on sales training, I went to work for them. I became a salesperson. I didn't report to anybody. I was on my own, I mean, other than the manager of the office. And they'd give you this apartment directory, and you'd sit there and dial for dollars, as they would call it. And you literally would call people during dinner, usually, because you're trying to, you know, people that own apartment buildings, interestingly enough, you know, that's their side business, especially from the 4-unit to the 50-unit. Those are people that bought them with, you know, 20 or 30% of the money they made every month. They saved up and bought an apartment building. And so you had their home phone number, and that was how you could get a hold of them. So typically interrupted them at dinner and then convinced these people that, hey, it's time to sell your 10-unit and go into a 40-unit. You know, take that equity that's built up and leverage it even more. Have some more fun. And so I was very good at that. My first year, I think I had 4 or 5 listings my first 60 days. I typically would average, I have a stat here. In the first 2.5 years with the Haynes Company, I did 200 transactions. I was top broker by 1981. Yeah, that's crazy. Now, these are small. Back then, you're talking about deals between 60 and 300,000. A half a million was a big deal back in, you know, 1977, 1978. And but I was making, I mean, my first 8 months in the business, or first 9 months, I made $80,000. And
boy, back then?
The job I had prior to that, I was working 3 12-hour shifts at a hospital emergency room while going through college, which actually equates to a little over full time. I made $12,000 a year. So I couldn't believe it. I mean, can you imagine when in two paychecks or two commission checks you'd make as much as I made all year?
$80,000 a year in 1976, 77, 78. That was a lot of money. I didn't make that much money as a lawyer, gosh, until 85.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because, when I got married, my father-in-law was a Harvard MBA and a CPA and had his own firm, and he told me the first time he broke $100,000 was in 1970. So he was a successful individual, but he's like 30 years older than me. And I was thinking, well, I broke $100,000 in 1979, '78 rather, because that was the first 9 months. Then the next year I made like $125,000, and I never made less than that ever again. And the interesting, in other words, it was like then it just continued from there. And I took the money. I lived at home, Howard, till I was 25. So here I was, well, that's only about 3 years into this business, I'm making this kind of money and I'm living at home. I took every dime and bought real estate with it, and I ended up, by the age of 26, I had 12 properties. And they range from 4 to 28 units. and no partners, just did this on my own. And I even would, up to that point, I would literally go out on the weekends and do the landscaping for these properties, and I did all the management. And fortunately, my boss, the guy that I reported to, that probably I now had more money than him, but he said, you realize what you're doing when you go out on the weekends and you mow the lawn. You're trading your $75 an hour job or $100 an hour job for a $5 an hour job.
Right.
And so that kind of thing really struck home with me. And so I realized that I need to stop doing that. And that's when I finally hired professional management to do the work for me.
Yeah.
So
I would like to say that the fact that you did it early on, not only is it reflective of you and your personality and your work ethic, but it's also, it gives you the knowledge to understand what's going on. If a landscaper goes out there and does a lousy job, you understand it. So getting your own hands dirty, literally, I think helps prepare you later on.
I absolutely right. I mean, really what was so interesting and why I did so well, I think, as a broker, I would have first-time clients that I'm showing them, they'd refinance their home and they'd be buying a 10-unit apartment building or something, and they'd be very nervous about buying it. And then I'd tell them that I own three properties like this, or whatever the number was at the time, and they'd look at me like, what? You know? And I said, yeah, and then I tell them about my story about the fourplex, and then I tell them how to solve the problem. For example, if there was termite infestation or the rents were low, how they can raise the rents by changing the carpet out and painting, and change, you know, we need a new oven here and we can get more money for this unit, and doing a rent survey for them, things that, you know, they hadn't thought about. And I did it with such passion because I was so convinced based on the fact that I'm doing it.
Yeah.
So if I can do it, you can do it. And they would sign up and they would buy from me. And, you know, I had repeat customers. I mean, that's how I got so many transactions. They would have success and they loved me. And I just had the personality and the passion for the business. I mean, to me, I was like, I almost would say, you're stupid if you don't buy this, you know, you're crazy. This is a great deal. And people want to hear that sometimes when they're buying something. They want to know that the salesman thinks it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. They need to feel that comfort level from the person selling them the product. And if they could feel that, they'll buy. And so it made me successful, and because I told them I did those things you just talked about, like I knew what it cost to paint a building. I knew what it cost to turn a unit. I knew what needed to be done in the landscaping. Oftentimes you buy these properties and the landscaping's overgrown. It would hide the property and it would make it look dated and so on. And I tell them, we cut out all those trees. We're going to clean the landscape and we're going to do this. And before you know it, they're as excited as I am. And so that really helped. I mean, actually owning what you sell makes a difference. It's kind of like, you know, the guy selling a Ford and he owns a Chevy. It wouldn't make sense. So if you're going to sell a Ford, you better own a Ford and drive a Ford.
So who are your mentors? Who were your mentors?
Well, besides my father, in terms of giving me direction and discipline, which he did very well. Bruce Haynes really was, because, you know, Bruce Haynes was a guy who barely, again, graduated from high school, never went to college, was from the Midwest, I think got kicked out of the house at 18, moved to California, and this guy, when I met him, he owned 800 units, I think pretty much debt-free. He was in his late 30s, and, I mean, this, you know, you're talking about, while making $100,000 a year, this guy was making about, I guesstimated at the time, he was probably making $60,000-$70,000 a month just in cash flow from his apartments. And he was extremely successful in my eyes, and he was one of the top salesmen before he started his own company, and he would still sell, even though, you know, he had three offices. He was one of the sales guys as well, and I think just about when I got into it, he had kind of exited the sales side. But he had a lot of big clients in Beverly Hills. His office was located there, and he owned that office. He owned the one in Sherman Oaks, and he owned the one I was starting in San Marino. So here's this guy in his late 30s. He owns the real estate that we work in, and he owns about a half a dozen apartment buildings, has about 800 units, and he's got this business, and he's very driven, very disciplined. You got to put in 12 hours a day to make it in this business, and you know, he would do a lot of the training. He wasn't that good at it, so he did. but his philosophy was really spot on for me. It worked for me. It didn't work for a lot of people, but it worked for me because I was young and hungry and eager to be successful. I didn't have a family, so I could put in those crazy hours that, you know, maybe, Howard, you put in when you were in your first or second year out of law school.
I still do. I'm probably, because of the economy, I probably work as hard now as I did then, except I have the added benefit of having a family that I'm responsible for. It seemed to
right.
be easier when I was younger because it didn't make any difference if you worked, you know, 15, 16, 17 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's what you did.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I did it, and I was putting in those hours. I would even work on the weekends. But he wanted you in the office by 8:30 in the morning, and the office didn't close till 8:30 in the evening. So, and you had to be there 3 days a week, or he'd fire you. And then 2 days you could be there for 8 to 10 hours. And so, but that was standard. That was just table stakes, just to stay in the business. And I loved it so much, I had spent most of my time doing real estate because I own these 12 properties, and then I was one of the top brokers in the office. And one of my big claims to fame, Howard, was that I had made $1 million by the time I was 26. I was a millionaire, technically. My net worth was about $1.1 million when I was 26 years old.
And that's when a million was $1 million.
Yeah, I tell that to my kids. I said, you really need to multiply that by five. You know,
not back then. Not back then.
I mean, I'm thinking a million then is like $5 million today.
Oh, yeah, so. at least. Roger, why don't you let everybody know about the people who pay the bills around here, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about some of Rand's best success stories or best lessons that he's learned over the years. And actually, I do want to get back to the issue about working hard, because that tends to be a misnomer that you can make lots of money as a real estate broker without working hard, and I found that to be just the opposite. So why don't we take another break?
Here's an exciting new tool for brokers and investors, RateBlend. RateBlend is a powerful online rent calculator that's quick and easy to use. Print and send detailed, effective rent analyses with a single click. RateBlend is easy to read, so what does your spreadsheet mean goes away. As a web app, RateBlend is accessible from your computer or any mobile device. Log on to creradio.com for Howard's comments, his one-on-one with developer Andrew Bermudez, and links to RateBlend. Try it today. If you need anything with your company logo on it, you need Monogram Magic. T-shirts, ball caps, polo shirts, anything. Monogram Magic does it beautifully, does it right, and does it right on time. For over 20 years, Monogram Magic has produced corporate apparel your people will be proud to wear. Large orders or small, it's all about attention to detail. See for yourself. Here's the website, logostolife.com. That's LOGOS, the number 2, then LIFE.com, logostolife.com.
Techniques Marketing can help you do more business with your biggest clients. We've developed exciting ways to increase your revenue streams with your key accounts, way beyond mere trial and error. And we've done it for some of the biggest companies in America. If you're happy with your numbers, great. If not, we should talk. Techniques Marketing, TECH, that's the tech, NIQUES, there you've got your NEEKS, TechniquesMarketing.com.
This is Commercial Real Estate Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a comment for Howard or his guests, please call 619-393-6492. That's area 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Welcome back to CRE Radio, where we're with Rand Sperry. And Rand, so what would you, why don't you tell us, say, your biggest and best lessons? They could be successes or they can be failures, whichever you choose.
Well, you know, I'll go back to early on, because I think some of the best lessons you learn, the earlier you learn them, the better off you are. the more they'll help you in the future. And
yeah, doesn't it bother you that you're still learning?
Yes. Yeah, you're off. That is just so true. It's like the day you stop learning is the day you die. And it is so true. I mean, I've had 37 years in the business, and I am constantly learning something I didn't know about this business and about myself and about what it takes to be successful. And one of the first lessons was very early on in my cold calling of trying to convince people to sell. I'll never forget this one time. I'm on the phone, very nice man, and we're talking, and now I don't think so, and I don't want to sell, and keep in touch, one of those type of phone calls. And so I hung up and kept going. I'll never forget it. It's not a big deal. But 2 weeks later, our office in Sherman Oaks, every time there was a listing, it would be sent to all the offices, so you'd have an opportunity to sell it. Here comes a sheet on that property that the guy said, no, I'm not interested in selling. 2 weeks later, I've got a sheet in my hand that shows me that, you know, obviously he was willing to sell. Someone else, more experienced, more capable, more willing to not accept a no, got the listing. And I thought to myself, my lesson there was that persistence pays. And I obviously missed something on that call. And I'll tell you a story about a success just in the same time frame that I'll never forget as well. That to me was pretty amazing in terms of a lesson on persistence. But one thing that I did learn too is that to read a lot of these self-help books on sales, and that is something that I do even today, and that is constantly get a motivational book about a rags to riches person or how to negotiate or, you know, salesmanship or so on. And they're so valuable for some of the listeners that might be listening to your show that are new to the business. I mean, you don't stop learning after you leave school. And sometimes that's really where you begin to really learn is after that. So this other story was about, I had a listing appointment, and again, it was in the evening because people work during the day. That owned a lot of these smaller apartment buildings. And so I go to their home, and it's a 9 o'clock at night meeting, and they're not home. And I'm thinking, well, this is pretty unusual. It's 9 o'clock at night and they're not home. And I'd met with them before, and they have two young children, and the kids aren't home either. And so I decide to wait. And I think about it in today's world, how long would somebody wait for that family to come home before they give up and leave? I mean, think about, and I hate to say our younger generation because every generation has impatience built into it, but I mean, what's the typical time? How long do you think someone would typically wait at 9 o'clock at night for somebody to get home? You have any idea, Howard?
I would say a half hour, maybe an hour maximum.
Yeah. But we're from the same vintage, and that would be an answer. My kids might say 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes max, and they'd be gone. I could just picture it. And so I went a full hour, and after an hour, I was getting pretty discouraged. Now, keep in mind, in our day, we didn't have anything to entertain us other than turn the radio on in your car. We couldn't sit there and look at our smartphones and be entertained through Facebook or whatever for an hour, because an hour will fly by today if you can do that. So sure enough, around 10 o'clock at night, they come rolling in, and I get out of my car, and they had completely forgot about the appointment. It was back to school night. And they just, you know, they got home at 10 o'clock at night from back to school, and the kids were there. And this couple was so, like, embarrassed that they forgot the appointment that they insisted that I sit down with them and go over the proposal. So there we are at 10 o'clock at night going over, you know, the proposal to list their property. And so they did agree to sell it, and they signed the listing, and I walked out of there with that listing. And I thought, well, you know, it really pays to hang in there. But the interesting thing is, and why it's a lesson I'll never forget, is because you could make the argument, well, I just rescheduled and then I would have got the listing. Well, the next morning, it couldn't have been 9 o'clock in the morning, I get a phone call, or maybe 10, I get a phone call from a residential broker who sells commercial, you know, one of the, like, Century 21 commercial division.
Sure.
And we kind of looked down on them because we were professional, suit and tie, and all we did was sell apartment buildings. So, but anyway, she calls me up and says to me, "You have my listing." I go, "What? What do you mean I have your listing?" They agreed to list that property with me. I had a meeting at 10 o'clock this morning with them, and they canceled my meeting because they said they listed it with you. That's my listing. And I'm like, well, sorry to tell you, it's not. And so she was really ripping into me for stealing her client and taking the listing. And, of course, I had no idea they were talking to anybody else. And so I just told her, you know, sorry, Charlie, and, you know, hung up on the phone. And, of course, I sold that property and made a nice check. But I thought to myself, had I done that, had I left and called him the next morning to reschedule, he would have been telling me, "I'm sorry I listed the property."
Yes, and you would have had another one of the prior cold calling experiences, not getting the listing.
Right, and that's why I hung out there, because of that prior experience. So, you know, the negative experiences help turn you around in your thinking and your logic and change your direction and put it in the right direction, if you let it. Don't let those negative experiences destroy you, which I've seen, because I've managed people. Within 2 years, I was managing the office I worked in, and I could see things, negative things happening that would destroy them. And you know, we talked about the fact that work ethic, and a lot of it is what really takes the wind out of the sails of an agent is the fact that the negative responses they get when they ask the question, "Will you list? Will you meet with me?" Or, you know, those type of things, you know, they can beat you down and knock you out of the business. I would say this is the real success rate for people that get into this business is probably about 20%, and I say that because a lot of people think that this is the get-rich-quick profession, and it really is not the get-rich-quick profession. You have to put, I believe, the time and effort into this business as you would anything else you would do, whether it's dentistry, medical, law, your CPA, you're manufacturing goods for clients. I mean, you need to be dedicated to that business to be successful at it. And I just get the impression out there from, you know, the outside world, I think they think that sales is a get-rich-quick business. And, of course, every profession has those type of stories and or negative people in their profession that give it a bad name. But if you want to be the best at this business and you want to be successful at it, you really got to work hard. And you will take a lot of rejection in the process.
Yeah, what you're saying is so, so true. It's I get the impression at times, particularly when the market is really good, people jump into being a residential. Actually, people tend to jump into residential because they just see things selling like crazy. You put up a sign and you just made $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, and they don't appreciate what it takes to be knowledgeable enough about the market, to be knowledgeable enough about the work that you're doing. It takes so much work, and I've been there, and frankly, I'm a lousy broker. I don't take rejection very well. I get tired of talking to people and trying to talk sense into them. I'm not a good salesperson in that respect, and I take it personally. You know, it just didn't work well, but it takes so much work. If you really want to be good, you got to do work. When the market's great, a monkey can make money. But the real test is during this market. And actually, now's a great time to jump into the market, in my opinion. If not over the last 6 months or so, it would have been a great time to become a broker and learn your business during the downtime, during the difficult time, so that when it gets easy, you actually get rewarded for all the hard work that you're doing.
Yeah. You have more respect for what you're doing because you really had to earn it beginning in a tough market.
Absolutely. I mean, if there's anything that you can learn, you should have been on a show that we did a couple of weeks ago with Rod Santamassimo and...
Santamassimo.
Santamassimo. Oh, he's going to show.
Yeah, he worked for me.
Yeah,
Rod
is Rod was on the show, and Mike Dernerin, my producer, was on the show. Mike's been in the radio business doing sales for 40 years, and we were talking about cold calling, and you know, the little tricks that you learn and the things that you have to pay attention to in the research, and you should have been on the line because what you were talking about just now was. It's so very, very true. You have to be tenacious. Not rude, but tenacious. My wife, who does cold calling and is a recruiter, she can get on the phone, call 100 people a day. She loves what she's doing, and she loves telling the story about one time calling someone up, and they hung up on her. And then she called him back and said, you know, there must have been something wrong with the connection because we got disconnected. And she got a client from that and made a deal.
Yeah.
And you just can't take those things personally. When we come back after these messages, I want to talk about what are the best attributes that you believe that have helped you or that pertain to your real estate career. And then I'd like to briefly talk about what you're doing now, because you've made some changes recently, and I think that the listeners should know about. So why don't we take a few minutes break, and we'll be back in a second.
Go mobile with the analyst. When the deal changes, and you know it will, be ready whenever, wherever, to update property analyses with the analyst. Multi-page reports in seconds sent straight from your mobile device to your client's email. Environmental summaries delivered right to your iPhone or iPad in as little as 10 minutes. Free from your desk at last with the analyst. Log on to creradio.com for Howard's comments, his one-on-one with developer Todd Kuhlman, and links to the analyst. If you're a retail tenant, you really should belong to the NRTA. They're an organization of the tenants, by the tenants, and for the tenants. Whether you manage a large portfolio or just a mom and pop, the National Retail Tenants Association is on your side. NRTA exists to protect retail tenants everywhere and to make sure landlord billings are correct. Don't wait for your next statement of CAM charges to arrive. Log on to retailtenants.org. That's retailtenants.org. Find out more today. What's next for commercial real estate and retail marketing? Pop-up retail, and it's here now. PopUpInsider.com is the premier online resource for owners to advertise and fill properties for temporary use. PopUpInsider.com is where merchants and brands shop for temporary locations. See for yourself. Go to PopUpInsider.com, create your own account, market your empty spaces, or view available locations for your business. All on one convenient site, PopUpInsider.com.
This is Commercial Real Estate Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a comment for Howard or his guests, please call 619-393-6492. That's area 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Welcome back to CRE Radio. We're with Rand Sperry. So, Rand, what are your best attributes as a professional real estate person?
Well, you know, we've talked about brokerage a lot, and I'll give you some of those, as well as I think it also in terms of investing in real estate. I think, you know, they're different, but there's a lot of commonality, I believe. But certainly it's different, like the story of your wife, you know, calling right back and then end up getting a deal out of it. I've got those stories too. Anybody who's a warrior on the phone, I think, has those stories. And so obviously being tenacious is an important attribute in the cold calling world and in the sales world. I mean, because I've got so many stories where, in fact, you really don't start making money until you hear a no. So one of the most important attributes is that that you can turn that no into a yes, and that is without offending somebody, really, or in annoying the hell out of them. And that, I think, is so important, because I think a lot of people get into this business, of the brokerage business at least, thinking that they're going to just get on the phone or they're going to talk to somebody and they're going to say, I got this great deal, and say, yes, I'll buy it. Because even if they say, yes, I'm interested, there's so many no's that are going to happen between that yes and the final closing, meaning, no, I won't pay that price, no, I won't do that down payment, no, that interest rate's too high, no, that property needs to be fixed, and so on. And you've got to turn those no's into yeses or create solutions, for sure. So problem solving is such an important attribute as well. And so, you know, you've got, there's just so many things. I mean, I look at it, and for me in my career, too, visualization is so important. You know, people, I remember when we had 7 or 8 offices at Sperry Van Ness when I was, an owner there and affiliated with them. And I remember a cocktail party we were having for the brokers, and somebody said to me, did you ever think it would amount to this? You know, and be this, like this size. And, you know, they've got 1,000 brokers in 170 locations across the country. And we were sipping on a glass of wine in, I think, Innsbruck somewhere, on one of the reward vacations that we offer, depending on how much money you make in that year. And I said, absolutely. I said, from the very first office, both Mark Van Ness and myself, we never planned on having one office in Newport Beach. We always looked at this as the beginning, and that we were going to grow this company. And I remember talking to Bruce Haynes, because I eventually became the general sales manager of the company, the number two guy there, before I left. I was there 10 years. And so I was top broker. I was the number two guy in the company in terms of the hierarchy. I oversaw the offices, and you know, I was a real estate investor with a couple $1 million in net worth at the time, and so with all that, you have to visualize. And I said to him, I said, Bruce, we could take the platform you have here and go national. You could be a national company. And I'll never forget, we had just opened up, I think, in San Diego, and he said as soon as San Diego is profitable. I laugh about that today, because it's kind of like, if you, even when you have a multi-office location of any business you're in, to have every single one of them be profitable every month, you know, it doesn't normally happen. In-N-Out Burger, by the way, is an ex- exceptional example of it where it does, and there's plenty of businesses, I guess, that's true. But in real estate, you have your ups and downs depending on the location and so on. And so I thought, well, we'll never be national because the minute that one's profitable, maybe the one in the San Fernando Valley might not be, and so on. So that's what stopped him. He could not see himself as a national real estate company. And he didn't see himself as having a good enough platform to educate and train and bring people into this business. And I think both Mark Van Ness and I did. And so being able to think outside of where you are right now and what you could be and the possibilities, I think it's important. And you look at anyone who's been successful in their career and in life and, you know, are icons in their industry, they had to have that vision at some point in order to get there. And it's kind of like I tell somebody starting new in the business, I said, well, you want to make $100,000 or six-figure income in this business, you got to think that way today in order to be that way tomorrow. And what that means is if you're making $100,000 to $999,000 a year, are you coming in at 10 o'clock in the morning and leaving at 5 o'clock to go hang out with your buddies at happy hour? Do you really think guys making $500,000 a year are doing that? Are you taking 2 weeks off here and 2 weeks off there? And do you read books on the business you're in? Do you continue to further your education? Do you do all the things you need to do to make the kind of money that you want to make now, not when you're successful, because you won't ever be that successful if you're not doing those things now. So, you know, that to me is an important characteristic of someone that wants to get into this business. They have to behave today like they want to be in the future. And so, and it takes a lot. It's not just getting lucky with one phone call and somebody says, I'm going to buy everything you ever show me, because that's just not going to happen. It's a tough business. And you've got to really work your way into it.
Our producer, Mike Dernerin, equates the no's on cold calling. He says, you know, you're going to have so many no's, so when you start calling, figure that you really want to get as many in as possible, as soon as possible, so you can get to some yeses, because that's how you're going to learn.
Right, right. And then, but the thing is, that's very true, meaning that, yes, I'm willing to talk to you, but the thing is that what I found is that there's no way people are always going to say no before they say yes, typically. And you know, a lot of brokers don't understand that even though they get a property under contract or they get somebody willing to meet with them, you know, whenever they hear that no, all it means is I need further clarification. Because based on what you're telling me, I'm not going to buy. And so sometimes those no's stop the typical salesman. And all that means is they want more information in order to make an educated decision. And so, and I just see so many of these, especially younger brokers, that they get frightened by the no, and they're says, well, I don't want to offend them. And you know, especially when you come out of your adolescence and now you just graduated from college or you're 2 or 3 years into your work business, it's like you're not used to that. You aren't used to people treating you that way and saying no and taking that kind of negativity. If you get a normal job, I call it, you know, people treat you nice. Oh, hi, welcome to the firm, and here's your office, and, you know, what can I get you your coffee? And you're not on the phone where people are slamming the phone in your face or saying, stop bugging me, or in order to get a paycheck, you have to get from a no to a yes. And that's really what this business is all about. In order to get to a paycheck, you have to convince somebody that at the moment is not buying into buying. And so anyway, that's important. You know, I got to tell you, one of the key things on acquiring real estate, which, you know, as an investor, I just want to bring this point up because this is so important and it's totally you haven't asked this question, but in terms of being successful in acquisitions and real estate today, one of the things that I've found that people aren't doing, and now I'm talking to the principals that might be listening, is that they find a good opportunity and they buy the opportunity and they rely too much on their broker for the information. And one thing I have to say is that you have to kind of think, if you were an ex-broker at one time, you have to think like them and not depend on them for the answers and find them for yourself. One of the things that we do when we acquire a piece of real estate is we sit down with every tenant on a building we acquire, and it's all commercial, and we talk to them about the fact that about how they like it in the building. Are they going to extend when their lease expires? What are the pros to being here? What are the cons to being here? And so on. So it really is an important aspect from a principal standpoint when you talk about what are some of the qualities. And they kind of are the same. You've got to do your homework. You've got to really put the time and effort in before you acquire a property. And I don't think I did that when I bought that fourplex.
No, but you're talking about due diligence. And let me add, I've spoken with Burton on a number of occasions, and that's one of the key elements that he expressed to me. Because we talked about brokers investing in their own properties, and obviously that's something very important to both of you. And I got to tell you that is... I've seen so little over the last 10 years due diligence that it's almost shocking to me.
Well, it keeps the lawyers in business because when we have been sued as a company, when I was formerly with Sperry Van Ness and I'd look at these lawsuits, you know, I'd read them and I go, well, if they would have just interviewed the tenants. If they would have, I mean, as crazy as it sounds, a lot of those issues had to do with stuff they discovered after they bought the property.
Absolutely.
And they started talking to the tenants. Well, and they go, well, the broker didn't tell me that. So the next thing you know, they want to sue the broker.
That's exactly what, now I am usually retained after a foreclosure. So there's not the same kind of due diligence. But I'm also retained and handle landlord-tenant stuff. And dealing with leases and tenants where the problems existed prior to the purchase, really. There's a history there. And it flabbergasts me that, well, didn't anybody ever look at any of this stuff? No. Which at the time, the philosophy was just buy it. You can overpay, it doesn't make any difference. The price is going to go up, and it doesn't make any difference what the problems are. And, of course, when the market doesn't stay in a skyrocket fashion, that's no longer true.
Gosh, we had one situation where we got sued because it was a single tenant, like hamburger stand type of thing, and the owner of the business had the opportunity to buy it. He had first right of refusal, and we sold the property. And he said, "Hey," waves his hand. No one gave me notice, and I want to buy it. And so talk about a lawsuit and rescinding this. Oh my God! And then I look at the thing, and I said, "Well, did you guys read the lease?" And, well, kind of. I go, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, they read the first few pages or something, and they didn't read the entire lease where he had the first right of refusal. And the seller had forgot about it in there. And so here you've got the seller and the broker being sued by this individual, the tenant, so to speak, because he had first right of refusal, because they didn't spend the time reviewing the lease, either of them. And again, those are things that, or what if they would have actually interviewed the tenant? They would have found, I said, well, what do you mean you're selling the property? I have the first right of refusal. And so again, it all boils down to just kicking the bricks and talking to the people.
No estoppel certificates?
Well, you know, they did an estoppel, and it wasn't in the estoppel that he had the first right of refusal. That was like the only thing we had going for us in the case.
Yeah, so there.
But they wrote him a check. He,
yeah,
they,
yeah.
wrote him a check, and he didn't end up buying it.
Yeah,
but,
I understand.
But that was our defense. He didn't put it in the estoppel, and he said he didn't understand estoppels and all that stuff. So
I could go on and talk about the effort that has to go into making sure that you don't get lazy and you just read the first couple of pages. You know, of course, the problem is when someone asks me to do it, sometimes you want to go, let me go through. It's kind of standard stuff, not going to pay much attention. And then I go, no. I have to take the time and read this and make sure that I'm picking up everything that there is. And it's honestly, it's not all that easy at times, particularly when everybody wants you to do things yesterday.
Yep. And that's the key to a good lawyer, is not to assume that it's all standard boilerplate.
No.
They really do look at it.
Particularly in commercial work. Why don't we talk for a few minutes about what you're doing now? Because it's all very interesting.
Yep. I mean, really what I've done is, Mark Van Ness and I owned Sperry Van Ness together. We were equal partners, and the job was kind of done. I think we in 2000 we expanded the company, made the decision, hired a gentleman named David Frosch to spearhead it. I spent a lot of time with David to help him do that, because it was kind of funny after the first year of him trying to go out to different cities throughout the country. He said, they like what we've got to present, but they go, where's this Sperry or where's this Van Ness? Where are the people with the name on the door? And he said, Rand, I need to drag you around, and you need to go to these seminars. And so anyway, I did that for a few years, and then the larger the company got, the interesting thing is the less they really need you. And because, the people you hire want to run it and do it, and they've got the challenge. And so Mark and I kind of stepped out of that. And Mark sooner than me. I think he was okay with it quicker than I was. So I then started spending my time with Burton Young, who runs the asset management division of the company, and the equities. It was formerly called SVN Equities. It's now called Sperry Equities. And so I would spend my time there, because a lot of the investors were my personal relationships. And Howard, we didn't talk too much about that, but I do have another life besides my career, and I'm somewhat involved in charity and professional organizations. And so a lot of my investors came from my professional organizations that I were involved in, and we said, hey guys, you're not real estate people, but you like real estate. Why don't you invest in the deals we're buying? And so we created SVN Equities in 1998, and so then I was spending more time on that, and so it finally came to a point where Mark and I kind of like, what's your worth, what should we do? So we decided to basically, in essence, Mark currently owns the brokerage company, the franchise operation, and I retained the property management and SVN Equities, which is now Sperry Equities, and we made the financial buyouts with each other to make that all happen. And so it's now Burton Young, myself, and Jack Carroll, who are the principals of Sperry Commercial and Sperry Equities. And Sperry Van Ness is owned by Mark, and the majority is owned by Mark Van Ness through entities, I guess. I don't know if he specifically owns it. But so we are completely separate and not affiliated anymore. And, it's just the next chapter in life. It's kind of it happens in partnerships where, everyone wants to go their own way. Mark's children are grown, and he decided to move to Washington, and I still have a few kids in college, and, I like what I do, and I like working, and so I've continued on doing this, and I really think, Howard, this is the time to buy. I mean, I couldn't possibly go retire when the market is probably as ripe as it's been since the early 90s in terms of opportunity. And so that's really the direction Burton and I are taking this, is that we are in the process of raising money to buy deals, and more deals, because 6 years from now, 7 years from now, what we're buying today will be worth two and three times what we're paying for them.
Absolutely. This is the prime time to get into purchasing, brokerage. This is at a time when everybody's out. With that being said, you have to know what you're doing, because there's a lot of stuff that's being trumped out there, you know, where people are going, oh, the market's great, get in and just buy and spend money willy-nilly and do things that the way that it was done in 2002 and 2003. I don't think that's the way to do things, but I think this is a great time to get involved.
Yeah, it is. You know, I was just with we had a little social thing at the house, and one of my son's friends is selling residential, and he says, you know, he says, it's really improving. He says, I don't know that it'll never be as good. Values will never be where they were in 2007, you know, before the crash, but things are improving. And I thought, I didn't think, of course, I had to tell him, I said, are you serious? Not only will they be at the 27,000 level, but they will shoot way beyond 2007. And you will look back at the height of this market, and it will be the bottom of the next cycle, and which was true in the 90s too. I remember in 1989, I had a friend who was building apartment buildings in Anaheim, and it was to build them. It was $100,000 a door. Hugo Chavez, I think his name was, but no, that's the guy who just
yeah.
Hugo Avalez, and anyway. I'll never forget it because he lost. He had like three buildings. They were 100 to 200 unit apartments in Anaheim. Well done stuff, but it was costing $100 a door, and he was raising money to buy them. And of course, he lost them in the market, and the values dropped to about $45,000-$50,000 a door. And I thought he was crazy when they were at $100,000 a door. And you know, obviously, that market came completely back and went up probably to about $150,000 a door. Today they're probably dropped, or they're probably about the same. And so, you know, we went way beyond that high, and people were talking about, oh, we'll never see these kind of values again. And yes, we will. Not only will we see those values, we'll see it exceed those values. So that's happening right now. We are at the bottom of the trough coming up, and you have to be insane not to think so. It's the best time to be in this business.
Isn't that funny? In Southern California, when things go crazy, all you ever hear is buy real estate because it'll never go down. And of course, those of us who've been around long enough know, yes, it will go down. And now you're hearing people say it'll never be where it was before, and you go, yes, it will. Yes, it will. You know, there's never a never, except that when I was working at First Team, I had a manager who would say to me, you know, I think it was around 2007, he says, you know, it's never a bad time to buy, but there are bad times to sell.
Yeah.
And
We have a new saying in real estate, and it's not location, location, location. It's timing, timing, timing. It really is. It really is. And we began this show talking about that, and I really credit my timing on that fourplex more than my business acumen. And because I timed it right, I did well with it, not because I really knew what I was doing. So, but it was what I needed. It was the shot in the arm that I needed to say, I love this business. I want to do this for the rest of my life, and I'm going to make a commitment to it. And it's kind of weird, Howard, because, you know, I was at the crossroads of going to law school, and I knew that to do that, you got to be committed, and it's going to be your career for your rest of your life, as if you went to medical school or even a CPA. I mean, you look at it, most people that have those type of professions, that's what they do for the rest of their life. And I said, if I can do that in commercial real estate and commit to this for my life, I think I can do very well. And, you know, obviously it has served me well. I mean, I've raised 6 children. They've all went to private from K through college, whatever that is, 16. and we've traveled all over the world, and we've had a wonderful life, and I've had fun doing it. That's the crazy. Even the tough times, it's almost like I've got more energy and stuff because I love a challenge. I think that's part of
it. Keeps you going.
It keeps you going. A lot of people, they like things to be status quo, and I got to tell you, and I might have been true even with Mark Van Ness during that period, probably 2003 to 2007 or 2008. You know, we weren't challenged as individuals, and I think it got a little mundane and not so fun anymore doing what we were doing because, you know, the company was growing and all that, and that's why I focused more on the equity side at that point. And, you know, we need challenges in our life, even to the day we die. I mean, the minute you sit back and retire, you really do start dying.
You got to do something. I mean, that's for me, the radio show. It's like it's totally renewed me. It's a huge challenge trying to do that, the law practice and everything else. It's a huge challenge, but it's fun.
I can see you enjoy it, and you're very good at it.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. We're going to, our time is just about out right now. I'd like to mention that we have a couple of other shows coming up. On the 29th of March, we have a show called, we haven't decided on the show, but it's about building design and architectural copyrights. We don't like to use that name because it sounds terribly boring, but it really relates to what you can do on commercial buildings and what you need to avoid when you develop it, because we see development actually coming up in the next few years and all of the mistakes that people can make in these designs and everything. It's a kind of very narrow focus, but it'll be something very interesting to people who think about getting into development. Later on in April and May, we'll be having a show with Bob Poline regarding commercial real estate job market. We're going to be doing a green buildings show and the value of sustainability. Very hot topic. We're probably going to have over the next year 4 or 5 shows on sustainability. And we've got 3 guests coming up who are nationally known guess on that. And actually, we have about 8 or 9 shows scheduled, but one that I wanted to mention was Issues in Auctions and Distressed Property Sales, which is going to be a fun show since that's a hot topic. So, Bob, you've been a great, great interview and guest. I really appreciate you spending the time with us, and hopefully we'll be back and you and I could meet in other situations. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
And we are going to wrap up the show right now. So, Roger, if you would you please close the show for us? And again, Rand, thank you very much for such a great job on this show.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.
This has been CRE Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a topic you would like to discuss, Howard can be reached at 949-288-3707. That's area 949-288-3707. Or by email to howard@creradio.com. CRE Radio is a live and recorded radio show accessible from both the web
and your smartphone. Visit CREradio.com to download any broadcast anytime or to receive newsletters and updates from Howard. CRE Radio broadcasts are presented on an informational basis only, with the sole intent of educating our listeners. Howard and his guest conversations specifically do not intend to offer legal advice. If you need legal advice, we recommend you seek out your own counsel. Remember, laws and practices may vary from state to state. Please listen again next time to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Unauthorized editing or copying of portions of this show without the express written consent of CRE Radio is strictly prohibited. All rights reserved.
And that's a wrap.